Chapter 5, The Great Equalizer. We will be known as a culture that feared death and adored power, that tried to vanquish insecurity for the few and cared little for the penury of the many. Mary Oliver. Riots are a work of vast and incomprehensible mourning. Sean Bonney. The 2021 Global Climate Change Summit, COP26, in Glasgow, in Scotland, was a meeting about death from which those facing the most mortal threat were systemically excluded. The conference happened against the backdrop of the COVID-19 pandemic, which meant that the barriers to attendance for people on the front line of ecological crisis in the global south, already facing the racist border regime, were exceptionally high. According to the COP26 coalition, a UK-based civil society network mobilising around climate justice, a large proportion of those who had intended to come to Glasgow from the global south were unable to, in part due to the inaccessibility of vaccines. Both the climate and the COVID-19 crises and their collision at COP26 demonstrate the deadly impact of racial capitalism, in which the profit motive supersedes the value ascribed to certain lives. Capitalism is inhuman in that, beyond there being enough people to keep profit flowing upwards, it does not matter to the system whether we, individually, live or die. But within this system, some lives are worth more than others. Capitalist expansion depends upon rendering some lives disposable. Capitalism is, as the philosopher and political theorist Achille Mbembe describes, necropolitical. It entails the subjugation of life to the power of death, building what he calls death worlds. Forms of social existence in which vast populations are subjected to conditions of life conferring upon them the status of living dead. As rich nations prioritising corporate interests blocked access to life-saving COVID-19 vaccines in the global south, in turn preventing people from communities on the front line of the ecological crisis from attending COP26, they also obstructed a climate agreement that could have saved lives the world over, especially those most at risk from climate change. Of the COP26 agreement, Indigenous climate activist Thomas Joseph said, "The leaders pushing for market-based solutions and the commodification of our Mother Earth are signing a death sentence." Capitalism is killing us. For some people, capitalism might feel like a wily murderer, gradually sapping the life out of bodies and souls through unrelenting stress. For others, its murderousness is more immediate and brutal. The uneven death toll under capitalism plays out at all scales, including within, at, and across the deadly borders of the UK. Working class and racialised people in the UK face disproportionate threats from the climate crisis, for example. Structural inequalities mean they are more likely to breathe air with unlawful levels of pollution and are more likely to face homelessness because of extreme weather events due to low-quality housing. The years of the pandemic have underscored the ways in which systemic oppression and state violence narrate morality. COVID-19 deaths are raced and classed and have exposed society's grave ableism. People in prisons and detention centres have been left to die or to live in death-like conditions, with prisoners, for example, being locked in their cells for all but 60 minutes each day. Low-wage frontline workers, black and brown people, and disabled people have all lost their lives disproportionately during the pandemic. Some workers have been forced to labour throughout in unsafe conditions, scarce personal protective equipment, and inadequate sick pay, intensifying the threat of infection. And when it came to treating those with COVID-19, it soon became evident that disabled people's lives would not be treated with the same sanctity. Some COVID-19 patients with learning disabilities, for instance, were given "do not resuscitate" notices. As the pandemic was taking hold, in May 2020, George Floyd was murdered by white police officer Derek Chauvin in the United States. The Black Lives Matter movement took to the streets all over the world, demanding that the white supremacist institution of policing be demolished and that black lives be protected. In England and Wales, since 1990, there have been almost 2,000 deaths in police custody or otherwise following contact with the police. According to the charity Inquest, which campaigns and advocates on state-related deaths, the proportion of black, Asian and minoritised ethnicities, or BAME, deaths in custody where restraint or force was a factor, is more than double that of other deaths in custody. Police violence, this time against women, also made the headlines and sparked protest in March 2021 in the UK, following the abduction, rape, and murder of Sarah Everard by Wayne Cousins, a white Metropolitan Police officer who had formerly worked as a parliamentary guard and who used COVID laws to abduct Everard. After her disappearance, police characteristically responsibilised women for patriarchal violence, advising them to stay indoors at night. The previous year in June, two white Metropolitan Police officers, Denise Jaffa and Jamie Lewis, took selfies of themselves with the corpses of Nicole Smallman and Biba Henry, two black women who had been murdered in a London park, before sharing them in a police officer WhatsApp group, calling the victims dead birds. Death is certain for us all, but who dies, when and how, in what conditions, with what care, is a question of politics. The Great Equaliser? The deathly violence of global capitalism and the state plays out in gradual as well as sudden ways. Most people die of natural causes, which is to say a coroner has ruled out an external cause. This verdict is, in many ways, misleading. With the conditions of our lives being so tied up with the structures and mechanisms of capitalism, can our deaths ever be natural and free of external causes? As both the pandemic and the climate crisis demonstrate, natural deaths can be directly linked to the global economy. And whilst people are living longer overall, sickness, healthcare, aging, end-of-life care and death look very different depending on who you are and where you are. Life expectancy in the London Borough of Westminster is 10 years higher than in Glasgow. Tory-linked private healthcare companies selling costly medical checkups, such as Randox, advertise using slogans like "Extend your life." Government policy determines life chances. As Philip Alston, the UN Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, wrote in his report on the impact of austerity in the UK in 2019, although the United Kingdom is the world's fifth largest economy, one-fifth of its population, 14 million people, live in poverty, and 1.5 million of them experienced destitution in 2017. Close to 40% of children are predicted to be living in poverty by 2021. Food banks have proliferated. Homelessness and rough sleeping have increased greatly. Tens of thousands of poor families must live in accommodation far from their schools, jobs and community networks. Life expectancy is falling for certain groups and the legal aid system has been decimated. Austerity, he wrote, adopted a harsh and uncaring ethos and an ideological approach to policy that has tragic social consequences. Many people who are unwell or disabled go without proper care. Indeed, it is difficult even to convince the government that you are not fit to work in order to access any state support at all. Those whose health means they are unable or unwilling to work are subject to a scroungers and shirkers narrative, rhetoric propelled by successive governments to invoke disdain for those without paid employment among those with jobs. Meanwhile, inaccessible and meagre benefits and low or non-existent sick pay force people to work when it poses health risks. Toxic work culture, like many aspects of our lives under capitalism, ruins our health as it ruins our world, in turn making us sicker, whilst we are obliged to be well enough to labour on. The ways we mine the planet, manufacture commodities, and are herded into certain lifestyles make us, along with the planet, unwell. As Audre Lorde wrote of her cancer diagnosis in the 1980s, "I'm not being paranoid when I say my cancer is as political as if some CIA agent brushed past me in the A train on March 15, 1965, and air-injected me with a long-fused cancer virus." What possible choices do most of us have in the air we breathe and the water we must drink? More recently, the poet Anne Boyer wrote of her cancer, "It is as if I am both sick with and treated by the 20th century, its weapons and pesticides, its epic generalizations, and its expensive festivals of death. Then, sick beyond sick from that century, I am made sick again from information, a sickness that is our century's own." The cancer treatment she was receiving, notes Boyer, have ecological implications. The price of her own individual getting better, she is aware, is making other living beings sick, such is life under capitalism. What about plain old dying from being old? Surely some things are sacred. Certainly, people are getting on. There are now, for the first time ever, more people over the age of 65 in the world than under 5. In 2019, 1/5 of the UK population was 65 or over. By 2043, people over 65 are expected to make up a quarter of the population overall. People living longer lives, however, does not necessarily mean more years of health and enjoyment. To match increasing life expectancies, the state increases retirement age rather than investing in provision for longer retirements. In today's economic climate, increasing numbers of people likely won't be able to afford to retire at all or to afford care when they need it. Dementia and Alzheimer's disease are the leading causes of death in the UK and the most financially devastating. The so-called dementia tax means that people unwell in this way, who are more likely to require social care rather than free hospital care and for longer, are burdened with care bills that the Alzheimer's Society estimates would take the average person 125 years to save for. Social care is in crisis due to underfunding, privatisation and financialisation. In the context of the United States, but just as relevant to the UK, the historian Gabriel Winant writes that, given the escalating care crisis, as well as those in housing and welfare, we will be facing a future of homeless shelters packed with octogenarians unless we act now. Millions of people have unmet care needs that make daily life a struggle, whilst for care workers, poor conditions, precarious contracts, and poverty wages prevail. Professional carers, of which there are around 1.5 million, many of whom have personal care responsibilities too, are critically overworked and underpaid. According to 2021 analysis by the Trade Union Congress, 70% of carers, mostly women, many of whom are migrants, earn less than £10 per hour. Unpaid carers, meanwhile, usually friends and family caring for people in their homes, are possibly eligible for a carer's allowance of just £69.70 per week, if they care for someone for at least 35 hours a week. Around 1.3 million people claim this unlivable allowance. In this landscape, the COVID-19 pandemic has underscored the fallacy of dying of natural causes. Not only did systemic vulnerabilities and crumbling state infrastructure lead to scores of avoidable deaths, but the origin of the pathogen itself is likely linked to the ecological crisis born out of the economic system. What's wrong with dying? Though every day we all get older and death is as inexorable as breathing, we mostly look away from our own mortality. Perhaps, as Susan Sontag posited, one can't look steadily at death any more than one can stare at the sun. But whilst fearing death may seem to be a universal life experience, our orientation towards aging and end of life is historically and culturally specific, rendered along lines of class, race, gender, and religion. How a society approaches death might reflect the dominant ideologies with which it approaches life. As death studies historian Cammie Fletcher writes, European settler colonialism, via slavery, war, and genocide, marginalised, trivialised, and outright negated death ways and death practices of nations, cultures, and persons deemed other. What are held up as common sense beliefs and practices around death in the UK today are linked to the histories and ongoing realities of colonialism, including white supremacy and the violent imposition of Christianity and capitalist cultures. The way we understand death influences how we relate to older people. In general, intergenerational mixing is not facilitated or encouraged. For most of our lives, unless we have proximate relationships with our immediate relatives, older age is somewhere else. A 2020 study by the Centre for Ageing Better found that the UK, in popular stereotypes and in the media, for example, demonstrates an ingrained culture of pity and dislike towards older people. The research found that ageism impacts some groups more than others, with people from black and minority ethnic groups and women facing a double jeopardy of ageist discrimination. Older people experience disproportionate levels of isolation and loneliness. Around 40% of people over 75 in the UK live alone, and older people with high care needs are more likely to receive care from a paid stranger in their private home or in a care home than to be cared for by loved ones sharing the responsibility. According to charity Age UK, One in 12 older adults report being lonely often, a number projected to increase. In a society that locates caring responsibility primarily within nuclear families, this is unsurprising. While society is set up so that older people may depend upon family care, if they indeed have a family to speak of, society is also organised and paced so that this kind of care, which in a different world people might long to do out of love, can be a devastating or impossible obligation. This immense pressure upon immediate biological family often leads to the breakdown of relationships, for example those of siblings. The care deficit so many people experience is not a unilateral cruelty, but a nightmare facing everyone. The idea that we ourselves may go uncared for at the end of our lives is a terrifying reckoning. As Sophie Lewis notes, lonely, fearful, disenfranchised deaths in turn breed trauma among the living. Via denial, dominant culture fetishizes youth. Whilst children and young people are denied agency, the fantasy of early adulthood is living your best life, being flawless, sprightly, hot, uninhibited. Even though the material conditions of young adults' lives are likely to be worse than those of their parents, they are less likely to have secure housing and work, for example. And even though they have been born into mounting global and societal crises, young adults are supposed to prosper. Whilst the young might find many good reasons to fear for their future lives, the very fact of their relative distance from old age is supposed to be an enviable peak experience. The cultural fascination with youth is expressed through a fixation on the body's largest organ, skin, which might give clues to ourselves and those perceiving us as to our proximity to death. It has been claimed that people are more likely to stop smoking for fear of its aesthetic, aging, impacts, rather than the ways it damages internal organs, making us likely to actually die sooner. The rise of skincare regimes, instructional makeup videos, and injectable fillers attests to the importance ascribed to a baby face sheen. Looking young and healthy, even when we are not, is rewarded. As Boya writes of meeting a friend while she has cancer, "On that day, I do everything to look healthy so that my friend will praise the skillfulness of my camouflage. Its materials purchased at wigs.com, CVS, and Sephora." She refers to look good, feel better workshops supported by the, often pinkwashing, cosmetics industry, which teach cancer patients to cover up areas of concern. As subjects in modern capitalism, we are urged to take care of ourselves, to self-preserve, by beauty brands and our bosses, rather than just by those who would actually suffer if we became seriously unwell or died. We are urged to put work into, as Eric Fromm puts it, camouflaging death. We are led to believe, more so as women, that to be young, healthy, and beautiful is to be lovable and desirable. The fact that, according to ableist, racist, transphobic, fatphobic, and conventional beauty standards, many of us will never be all three, then, may be profoundly distressing. It has become a popular feminist insistence that we only or primarily tend to our appearance for ourselves. But if we were guaranteed of a lifetime of cherishing love no matter how we looked, would we really spend so much time and money optimizing our assets? The biotech industry is seeking a cure for aging itself. The US military are conducting trials of an anti-aging pill developed by Metro International Biotech. "The pill," says Navy Commander Timothy A. Hawkins, a spokesperson for the Special Operations Command, whose mission is to advance US policies and objectives worldwide, "is about enhancing the mission readiness of our forces by improving performance characteristics that typically decline with age. Death defiance can have imperialist ends." It is often claimed that people, especially those living in Western cultures, are simply in denial about death. The founder of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud, wrote in 1918, "Our attitude towards death had not been a sincere one. To listen to us, we were, of course, prepared to maintain that death is the necessary termination of life. In practice, we were accustomed to act as if matters were quite different. We have shown an unmistakable tendency to put death aside, to eliminate it from life. We attempted to hush it up. In fact, we have the proverb, to think of something as of death. Of course, we meant our own death. In the unconscious, every one of us is convinced of his immortality." It might not be, however, that we are inherently unable to reckon with death, but that we live in a culture that ushers us into ignorance or convenient amnesia. Consumerism, for example, can be understood as a form of bargaining with death. Online shopping surged during the pandemic. The post-purchase dissonance that consumer psychologists describe, then, might be understood as the realization that the thing will not save us, though realizing this is unlikely to stop people trying again. The desiring itself is a kind of youth. And when does death befall us? At least we know the bodies of our phones will outlive our own. Our digital legacy will outlast us too. Indeed, tech companies now sell post-mortem services, arranging pre-scheduled posts to go out on deceased people's social media platforms. The posts might let friends or followers know you're dead, or send them birthday wishes from beyond the grave. James Norris, the founder of the platform Dead Social, told CNN in 2013 that the service allows users to literally extend the personality you had while alive in death, adding, "We're using tech to soften the impact that death has and dehumanize it. It allows us to think about death in a more logical way and detach ourselves from it." Long before tech services were announcing people's retirement from life on LinkedIn, however, the funeral industry was packaging death, promising to make it more bearable for a price. America's largest funeral corporation, notes the mortician and author Caitlin Doughty, has even trademarked the word dignity, arguing, "What dignity translates to, more often than not, is silence, a forced poise, a rigid formality." In 1963, the journalist Jessica Mitford, the sole communist in her aristocratic family, published a groundbreaking investigation into the funeral industry entitled The American Way of Death. Though its context was the white American culture around death, its findings remain relevant to the industry's workings in many parts of the global north, including the UK. Mitford exposed how funeral businesses harnessed the disorientating nature of grief in order to market and upsell expensive and unnecessary products and services to the bereaved. For example, she found that funeral directors usually claim that embalming, a chemical treatment that delays the body's decomposition by replacing blood with preservatives, was a legal requirement, when it was in fact a requirement fabricated by the industry. In profiteering from grief, argued Mitford, the funeral industry had played a huge, macabre, and expensive practical joke on the American public. The funeral industry mediates our relationship with death via profit, arguably distancing grievers from the corporeal reality of death by obscuring decay. Of one funeral Mitford attended for her research, she writes, "The funeral director has relieved the family of every detail. He has revamped the corpse to look like a living doll. He has arranged for it to nap for a few days in a slumber room. He has put on a well-oiled performance in which the concept of death played no part whatsoever. He and his team have given their all to score an upset victory over death." The process of embalming itself could be understood as a battle against death fought at the expense of the living. The standard embalming fluid, formaldehyde, is a known human carcinogen, placing mortician workers at an increased risk of cancer as they delay the decomposition of the already dead. How we bid farewell to loved ones matters. As well as celebrating their having lived, it helps us process our loss. Yet funerals, the standard next step for bereavement, often take a prescriptive approach to grief and bankrupt the grieving. Many people in the UK today face funeral poverty when the cost of a funeral, £4,000 on average, outstrips what they can afford. A 2020 report by the Competition and Markets Authority raised serious concerns about the funeral industry in relation to its lack of transparency on pricing and the potential exploitation of customers' emotional vulnerability. But whilst bereaved people's vulnerability is recognised for the purposes of profit, the unwieldiness of grief is rarely given space in our lives. Respectable grief is private, short-lived, and contained within a small circle of people. There is no statutory bereavement leave in the UK, meaning it is up to your boss whether you are permitted to take time off work to mourn, usually a few paid days at most. As with taking time off work to care for the dying, it is usually only acceptable professionally to ask for leave if the deceased was a close biological relative or partner. And when we get back to work, we are expected to leave death at home. Grieving is antithetical to productivity. Excessive mourners, argues the writer Julia Cooper, are punished, a socially enforced strategy of our neoliberal era. Grief is not supposed to be expressed in public, except for when it must be. Whilst grieving our loved ones is not supposed to interfere significantly with our productivity, ritualized mourning for the rich and powerful is traditionally an obligation of good citizenship. Some people are mourned publicly with state-sanctioned fanfare, especially the royal family, benefactor and profiteer of slavery and empire. The death of Queen Elizabeth II's husband, Prince Philip, well known to enjoy bigotry, initiated Operation Forthbridge, which detailed the protocols for an 8-day period of national mourning. Flags were lowered to half-mast, children's television was suspended, news presenters wore black, and radio stations played somber music. When his wife, 96-year-old Queen Elizabeth II, died on the 8th of September 2022, Operation London Bridge similarly set out the minutiae of mourning. All games were banned in royal parks, and the day of her state funeral, costing millions, was a national holiday, for which thousands of hospital appointments were cancelled. Public space was saturated with her image and condolences, lest the people forget the royal death, and public petitions to the government were paused. The queue of people waiting to see the monarch lying in state stretched up to 10 miles. A BBC News announcement of the Queen's ill health declared an important statement by the Prime Minister regarding the cost of living crisis, which is leaving millions struggling to survive, of course insignificant now due to the gravity of the situation we seem to be experiencing with Her Majesty. Later, a Sky News presenter was forced to apologise after mistakenly describing the 10th of September 1,000-strong protest for Chris Cabba, an unarmed 24-year-old black man killed by police days before the Queen's death, as people mourning the Queen, discussing their memories of her and their good wishes for the new king. During the period of national mourning, anti-monarchy protesters were arrested. In 2021, unusually, an ordinary person's death also compelled national mourning. When Captain Sir Tom Moore died, aged 100, during the pandemic, Prime Minister Boris Johnson urged members of the public to clap together at a particular time in his honour. Captain Tom was a British Army veteran who became a public figure after raising millions for the NHS by doing sponsored laps around his garden. Whilst presiding over the systematic decimation of the NHS and one of the highest COVID-19 excess death rates in Europe, Johnson paid tribute in Parliament to Captain Tom's efforts, saying he dedicated his life to serving his country and others and to defending our nation. To the government, Captain Tom's life was exemplary of British patriotism, and therefore mourning it was a matter of national pride. Most deaths do not inspire state mourning, especially not those caused by systemic violence. When asked whether he would take the knee in honour of black lives lost to racism, Johnson, having called for a national clapping ritual for Captain Tom, said he didn't believe in gestures. At times of collective grief for those killed by the state, police are not present to enforce mourning, as they are at royal funerals, for instance, but to quash it. When feminists held a peaceful vigil to mourn Sarah Everard and to protest gendered violence, cops from the same force as her murderer attacked and arrested grievers, six of whom faced prosecution. Demanding deaths. Our relationships to aging and death are inflected by the logic of capitalism. The ways we get older, experience the end of our own and others' lives, and grieve are culturally specific. Different peoples, in different places, at different times, have and have had vastly different feelings, beliefs, and practices around death. Not all death practices attempt denial. In From Here to Eternity, Doty considers how a dominant culture of death denial in the West does a disservice to the deceased and the living, and explores different cultures of mortality. Whilst insisting there is no right or better way to grieve, she considers death practices that display more of a soft, porous border with death than do normative Western rituals today, suggesting they might offer clues as to how to build more attuned relationships to death, and therefore to ourselves, each other, and the world. Open-air cremation pyres are central to many death rituals past and present. In the UK, they have been illegal since a 1930 revision of the 1902 Cremation Act, prohibiting the fulfilment of Hindu and Sikh death rites in particular. To some believers, the prohibition of this ritual amounts to the prohibition of reincarnation. Since 2006, the founder of the Anglo-Asian Friendship Society, Devendra Ghai, a British Hindu who migrated to Britain from Kenya in the 1950s, has been campaigning for open-air cremations to be made possible in the UK. As a spiritual tradition, as well as an alternative, low-cost option for everyone. In 2010, he won a legal battle in the Court of Appeal for the right to be cremated on an open-air pyre in line with his religious beliefs. Opposing him in court was Jonathan Swift, representing the Ministry of Justice, who argued that the sacred death ritual defied decorum and decency. To create better conditions for growing older, dying, and grieving, we need to pay attention to the ways in which dominant ideologies and the state intensify suffering and hamper our relationships to death. In fighting for a more livable society, we are also fighting for better deaths. Our movements for a world marked by care, safety, and freedom, for housing, for healthcare, for anti-racism, for trans liberation, for climate, are part of building a world in which aging, death, and grieving well might be reclaimed as a birthright to be experienced on our own terms rather than a terrain of struggle. Reclaimed grief, in turn, could feed into radical movements. As the artist, educator, and embodiment researcher Camille Sapara Barton writes in The Global Environment's Network Grief Toolkit, I imagine regular grief rituals being incorporated into movements for social change, as well as other networks, as a practice of care and interdependence. Everyone will be encouraged to attend monthly grief rituals as an entry point for organising work. Communal weeping and emotional release will become normalised, held with the knowledge that this allows us to compost our beliefs and make space for more presence to show up. Be flexible in our thinking and operate in ways that feel aligned with our values. These grief spaces will enable us to make generative connections between our own lives, our ancestors, and the stories of the lands we inhabit or are ancestrally connected with. Recognising how racism has shaped dominant ideologies and practices around death today is an essential part of creating the conditions for better deaths. The Collective for Radical Death Studies, or CRDS, a collective of scholars, funeral directors, death work practitioners, activists, and students of death studies, who view death work as synonymous with anti-racism work, synonymous with actively dismantling oppression, and as a way to validate cultural and social life among marginalised groups, is working to decolonise death studies in theory and in practice. The collective aims to create change in the field by decentering whiteness, centering deathways of racialised groups, and radicalising death practices, whilst underscoring the ways in which systemic oppression determines the life and death chances of marginalised groups. The group's goals are 1. To create a radical death canon that can be adapted as a tool by death educators, death scholars, death practitioners, and all those interested in understanding death, dying, and the rituals of care provided from a decolonised perspective. 2. To increase diversity in death scholarship and conversations beyond class analysis. 3. Working to analyse how death, mourning, burial, and death investigations have changed over time along the lines of race, class, gender, ability and or disability, sexuality. And 4. To serve as a resource for a discerned understanding of the end-of-life experience and rituals around death for marginalised people and their communities. Liberation means remaking a world in which everyone is deserving, in which everyone's existence matters, in which everyone is grievable. As Sara Ahmed puts it in relation to queerness, when queer grief is not recognised because queer relationships are not recognised, then you become non-relatives, you become unrelated, you become not. Fighting for better deaths is fighting for everyone's becoming. Care is what becomes us. Currently, the care crisis is exacerbating suffering for both the cared for and carers in institutionalised and domestic settings. The care system as we know it urgently needs resourcing that reflects its value to people's quality of life and death in society as it stands. But funding is not enough. As Emma Dowling argues, money will not solve the care crisis if it is used to prop up commodified care. Real change needs to address the failures of privatisation by regulating against wealth extraction and ending the competitive procurement practices that incentivise a race to the bottom. We must also radically reorganise how we care for ourselves and each other by rethinking access and ownership within care infrastructures. Dowling makes the case for care municipalism to galvanise a strategy, bringing social care back under the control of public bodies, where it can be planned and delivered directly, and democratising public ownership models in partnership with communities. Ensuring better working conditions for carers is a central element of this, and indeed, care workers are fighting and winning. In 2020, outsourced adult social care workers in Bath fought to get their jobs brought back under the remit of the local authority alongside their union. Resisting the care crisis is part of an anti-capitalist struggle. As Dowling writes, if care cannot solve the problems of capitalism, capitalism is indeed preventing us from solving the problems of care. Ending the care crisis means transforming the conditions for caring. To do so requires fundamentally rethinking how to value care. Care work is extremely underappreciated in our society because it is work historically, and mostly still, done by women, in large part working class women from racialized groups. Such feminized labor is not seen as real or important work, and as such, goes unrecognized and is under or unpaid. Building a world in which caring for each other is central rather than peripheral to the organization of our communities must be at the heart of the feminist movement. As we build a future in which everyone gets the care they need in older age and throughout their lives, we must refuse the care privations of the state and nuclear family and organise caring labour among us as a collective and mutual endeavour. As part of this work, we might reorient ourselves to ageing by seeking to build intergenerational networks of kin and comrades. We will all be old someday, must cease to be a resignation and instead become a rallying cry. Firstly, because it is not entirely true, not everyone who wishes to live a long life will, and too often this is because of structural oppression and systemic violence. Secondly, because insofar as it is true, in that many of us imagine we might be old one day, and in that all of us know, at least on some level, that we will die, it must not be a source of fear-based division, but of solidarity. Where the young and old are routinely pitted against each other by governments, as groups vying for limited resources, for example, or as groups who impede each other's lives, people of all ages might defy this logic by building intergenerational communities and networks of mutual aid. Just as this means integrating collective childcare into the infrastructure we build, it also means ensuring spaces are welcoming and accessible for everyone, including people towards the end of their lives. The pandemic era offers inspiration. In responding to the urgency of survival, many local mutual aid groups took the idea that all we have is each other seriously, understanding that it is all of our responsibilities to look after everyone. If older members of mutual aid groups were isolating more frequently and rigorously, for example, neighbours less vulnerable to COVID-19 supported them in meeting their needs. Radical collaborations with elders challenge the notion that older people are inevitably conservative. Recently, in both the anti-fracking movement and the campaign group Insulate Britain, older people have been visible and vocal on the front lines of resisting the ecological crisis. In nurturing intergenerational communities of care and resistance, we might find, as Winant suggests, that new solidarities may form, new varieties of care, love and responsibility may take shape, and from them, power. Solidarity forever. It is often said that among the most painful aspects of life is the fact that we face death alone. This reality, claims the psychotherapist Irvin D. Yalom, is one source of our existential isolation, a profound form of loneliness stemming from the unbridgeable gap between the individual and other people. Finding ways to make each other feel held as we search for peace with our essential separateness, then, could be a radical act. Though we will, all of us, no matter what, exit aliveness alone, we are all in this together, and no one should have to do death unaccompanied. According to the Death Acceptance Organisation, the Order of the Good Death, founded by Doty, being death positive means believing that it is not morbid or taboo to speak openly about death, and seeing honest conversations about death and dying as the cornerstone of a healthy society. Indeed, as Barton writes, many traditional cultures, especially before colonisation, had collective grief practices and rituals for communities to process feelings of loss. For example, the Dogara people of Burkina Faso have a monthly collective grief ritual that is taboo to miss. They believe that untended grief leads to harm and suffering in the collective. Today's growing community of death doulas is attempting to cultivate more intimate experiences of death. Like birth doulas, death doulas seek to facilitate and nurture life's transitions. This might include providing support for the practical considerations of a good death, but also, just as importantly, negotiating and tending to the emotional landscape alongside the dying and those close to them. Intentional relationships to death are also fostered in death cafes, public discussion groups where people are free to share their ideas and feelings about death, and grief circles where people meet to tend to one another's experiences of loss. How can we create and maintain these spaces such that they are accessible, comfortable, and safe for all? Building the capacity for loving mutual aid around life's transitions is an essential form of solidarity. If we trust that ourselves and our kin will be cared for at the end of our lives, we may feel less afraid of the isolation of death, and therefore be more attentive to what it could mean to be alive together. Being alive together might mean, for instance, a collective responsibility to build a world in which being alive is better. There is power in grief because it is wild. It cannot and must not be contained. It stops us in our tracks and makes collusion with capitalist logic impossible. It may leave us unable to do anything but exist. Indeed, we might grieve all that we have lost due to capitalism itself, as well as living beings, the lives we are unable to live. Grief can bring our awareness to what matters most, and in doing so, be a source of radical intimacy and transformation. Grief, in this invocation, is not a solitary feeling. Indeed, for many people, grief is always already collective, and death practices themselves can be a form of resistance. The Chicano movement in the United States in the 1970s, inspired by resistance among Mexicans and the Black Power movement, fought to reclaim indigenous identity whilst fighting state oppressions, including police brutality and assimilation strategies. The movement's resistance included practicing Day of the Dead or Dia de los Muertos celebrations and artistic traditions in public. To this day, Dia de los Muertos rituals are part of anti-racist protest and mourning. In 2019, following the El Paso massacre in Texas, where a white nationalist targeting the Latinx community killed 23 people, mourners set up an altar with offerings near the site of the atrocity. In the shared mourning of lives lost to systemic violence, effective solidarity is radical action. Living in the age of social media, during a global pandemic and ecological crisis, we arguably experience an especially heavy psychic burden of death. Death is not only an intimate thing we go through with those close to us, but something we are aware is happening at a magnitude and pace that is difficult to truly comprehend. We must orientate ourselves to death such that we reckon with the ways it is unfairly, violently distributed. How can we face the grief of the world without sinking into desolation and instead harness it to ignite collective power? We could start by trying to accept life's evanescence. In recognizing the temporariness of existence, our own as well as that of all living beings, we might reorientate ourselves to life and comprehend afresh what is at stake in fighting for survival. This is reason to unite as well as to learn from each other. The significance of dying is not the same for everyone. In coming to terms with the many meanings of death, let us find ways to rebirth a world in which everyone is free to die and live well.